Hi, I'm Monica Olson.
And I'm Jennifer Walsh.
And you're listening to the Biophilic Solutions Podcast, where every other week we sit down with experts and thought leaders in order to explore the innate connection between humans and nature and why we need nature to thrive.
We truly believe that reconnecting with the natural world and understanding our place within nature is a key to tackling the global environmental problems we face today.
So let's get to today's episode. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Monica.
So, Jen, in previous interviews, we've talked about the biodiversity crisis. And our interview with Nina Marie Lister, we really focused on the barriers that people face when they attempt to plant native pollinator gardens, particularly in their front lawns. I mean, she was like practically taken to court.
She was.
So, you know, we want to tell our listeners who we've been speaking with today, because I really feel like this conversation helped me understand the connections between native plants and the food system, as well as some of the very doable steps we can make a difference.
Yes, of course. So today we're chatting with Doug Tallamy, the T.A. Baker Professor of Agriculture in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. Doug is the author of over 112 publications, including books like Bringing Nature Home, The Living Landscape, Nature's Best Hope, and his latest, The Nature of Oaks.
112 publications. That's wild.
No. So
Doug is also the founder of Homegrown National Park, which is a really great organization whose mission is to convert 20 million acres of privately owned land, basically from lawns, to native gardens that support plant and animal life.
I found this conversation so fascinating, and I learned about some really cool concepts I'd never really heard of, like keystone species, which we'll get into, but mainly I was struck by how accessible the solutions really are.
Yeah, Doug has a great way of breaking down the issues into very understandable concepts and giving people common sense, very doable action steps that don't feel daunting or overwhelming.
Oh, I completely agree with that. So let's get to our conversation with Doug Tallamy.
Doug, so good to meet you in person. We're thrilled to have you on Biophilic Solutions Day. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm so excited for this conversation, Doug. We've been talking so much about you and your work. So we're very appreciative for you to take the time to discuss your work with us and your background. So thanks for being here.
We'd love to sort of jump right in. I think a lot of people know and follow insects around their lives, but they may not know what entomology is or why one would be interested in it and the importance of it. So I'd love to kick off with, you know, what sort of your background and what led you into the research and studies that you do.
Oh, boy. I was born. Nobody had to convince me that natural things were interesting, but growing up, I didn't know anything about insects. I liked turtles and snakes. And in college, I was a biology major, and I had an entomology course taught by Dr. Bugbee, no less, in my junior year. And it was really interesting. So I ended up going into entomology in graduate school. Entomology is the study of insects. I really focused on ecological interactions, behavioral interactions. I would call myself a behavioral ecologist that focuses on insects. They're very convenient research organisms because they have such fast generation times. And I didn't get into the conservation aspects until about 20 years later when my wife and I moved onto our property in Southeast Pennsylvania. It was thoroughly overrun with non-native plants. And it was there that I realized, well, our insects really are not eating these. And we started to look into it, got some funding for some research and found out it is a major problem. It is a major cause of insect declines and it's not on anybody's radar. So that really was what stimulated me to change the direction of my research and try to take this very simple message. You know, as E.O. Wilson told us, life as we know it depends on insects. So losing them is not an option. And we are losing them. So, but there's many things we can do to turn that around.
I'm glad you said that, Doug, because I feel like in your work and what you've done, and E.O. Wilson has really taught us, I believe, is the fact that the smallest creatures on the planet are often the most important. And we always think that we are so important. We are the ones in charge. We are the ones in control. Yet these tiny, tiny little creatures hold the value and really like this tethering to all that we do and all that we are. I mean, that must have been a really interesting discovery for you too, as well, I would assume.
Yeah. You know, in 1987, that's when Wilson wrote his paper, The Little Things That Run the World. I remember sitting in my office. I was an entomologist. You know, I knew about insects, but I'd never really thought about their important roles. It was interesting reading back then, but in 1987, nobody was worried about losing insects, and we didn't know anything about invasive plants. And it was interesting, but it didn't turn the corner for me. I said, the connection with plants is the critical one. Plants are capturing energy from the sun. They're turning it into food. And if you don't pass that food on to other animals, you don't have animals, you don't have functional ecosystems. Well, it turns out that first of all, insects are pollinating those plants. So you won't have them if you don't have the insects. And then they're the major creatures transferring energy from plants to vertebrates. So if we lose our insects, we lose our mammals, our reptiles, our amphibians, and our birds. And that includes us. That makes insects pretty important.
Well, and when you say that they're transferring the energy, what you're saying is that they're being eaten, right?
Through photosynthesis, plants are capturing the energy from the sun and they turn it into simple sugars and carbohydrates, which is the food that supports just about all the animals on the planet. But most vertebrates don't eat plants directly. Most vertebrates eat insects that ate those plants. And in North America, at least, those insects, most of the ones are caterpillars. Caterpillars are transferring more energy from plants to other animals than any other type of plant eater. And the birds represent that really well. 96% of our terrestrial birds in North America rear their young on insects. Most of those insects are caterpillars. And you're talking about thousands of caterpillars to get one clutch of birds to the point where they leave the nest. So if you don't have the plants that are making the caterpillars, you essentially have a failed food web. And if you have failed food webs, you eventually have failed ecosystems. That's where the native plant connection comes in, because native plants support insects, particularly those caterpillars, far better than the non-natives.
We've talked a lot about, Jen and I, about soil health and then the plants. You know, what's in the soil is super important to the plants, but this is a whole nother level that I think we haven't really dug into in a while. So talk about that food system and what you're seeing, changes that are happening, and maybe even just what you did on your own property.
Okay. When you said it's another level you haven't talked about, you're exactly right. It's another trophic level. So plants are the first trophic level. The things that eat plants are the second trophic level, the herbivores. And then the things that eat those herbivores are the third trophic level. People talk about a food chain. It's really a food web. You know, a single plant will have lots of things eating it and lots of things eating them, and it looks like a spider web. It does all start with plants. If you take those plants away, it all crashes. And when we moved into our property, it had been a farm for 300 years. And the last thing they did was mow it for hay. So there were really very few plants there, very few woody plants. And our job was to put it back together. We wanted to recreate the eastern deciduous forest that used to be there. So we did. We started putting in plants. And you can measure the productivity and the stability of your local food web because those caterpillars are so important. If you know the number of species of caterpillars, particularly moths, in your local food web, you have a very good index of how well that food web's doing. 6 years ago, I started counting all the species of moths that make a living in our house. And I do that by taking their pictures. So I have this giant PowerPoint of all the species. But I'm up to 1,259 species of moths that are making a living at our house now because we put the plants back. That demonstrates nature's resilience. If you put the plants back, things come back. You know, the World Wildlife Fund talks about Earth losing 2/3 of its wildlife since 1970. You hear that all the time, and it's a terrible statistic. When I think of what's happened at our house, I am sure we have increased biodiversity by more than 2/3, and it didn't take that long, and it wasn't that hard. We just put the plants back. We've got 62 species of birds that have bred on our 10 acres because we put the plants back and made those caterpillars. So what impresses me is, or what would impress me, is if everybody put the plants back, we really could turn around a lot of these terrible headlines.
So what does that look like, put the plants back? You know, I think, you know, is that putting a garden in? Is that putting some hydrangeas in and some pansies? Like, what does it that mean to put the plants back?
I should say put the native plants back because the hydrangeas and the pansies aren't going to, they're decorations. Yep. And that's great. We can have some decorations. Yep. You know, we've got 44 million acres of lawn in this country. But it's not supporting the food web. It's not supporting the pollinators. It's not managing our watershed, and it's not sequestering carbon. So it's the worst plant that you can have. And 44 million acres is an area bigger than the size of New England. So I kind of count that as a nothing. And planting an oak tree in the middle of that lawn, that's putting a plant back. If you do plant a little pollinator garden, you've created, and that's something you're not going to mow and destroy every week. There's a thousand ways to put the plants back, but lawn isn't one.
I think education has got to be key for like these neighborhoods or communities, just local communities, just saying why. And I don't understand why more communities aren't having someone come at the city hall or some kind of, I don't know, there should be more I'm assuming there should be more activations locally or community wise, just to say why we need to bring our gardens back, our yards back, our soil back. And it's so simple. Like you just said, it doesn't take a lot. It's just knowledge, really.
You know, that's starting to happen more than you think. I've been talking about this for 20 years, and I do see the needle moving. There are a lot of people out there talking about this. It's not going to come from City Hall. Somebody's got to talk to City Hall. But people are starting to realize, you know, they hear the headlines. We've lost 3 billion breeding birds in the last 50 years, and that upsets them. But they think there's nothing they can do about it. So my message is, no, there's plenty of things you can do about it. You can see the differences. Right. And that little piece of the earth that you, quote, own. Ownership means it's you have the responsibility of being a good steward of that piece of the earth.
Yep.
Everybody requires functioning ecosystems. It's not a red, blue, issue. It's not a tree hugger, non-tree hugger issue. Every single person requires healthy ecosystems. We've got parks and we've got preserves. And they're doing the best they can, but we are in the sixth great extinction event, which means it's not good enough. So we have to practice conservation on properties in between those parks and preserves. That's private property. And that's where everybody, that's where this giant army of millions of people who are going to be the future of conservation, that's where they come in to play. And the big problem is they don't know that. So
that's it.
Well, you did do an article. I don't know how recent it was, but I read it that was Meet the Ecologist Who Wants to Unleash the Wild in Your Backyard, right? Using your land as a model, which is fantastic. I mean, it's like, as somebody who does a lot of press, like that is a huge part of getting the word out, right? Is you out there talking, ideally us amplifying. But I do think having a third party tell your story is super important. So what are those steps that we need to take to rewild?
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Jennifer, guess what's coming up and where we get to hang out?
What's that, Monica?
The Biophilic Leadership Summit. It's back this March 24th through 26th.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see you in person again. It's been way too long.
I know, me too. And we invite all our listeners to come to this year's summit. We're going to be exploring biophilic placemaking and how we use biophilic principles to promote health, happiness, and vitality in public spaces.
Yes, and I was just reading over the schedule, which I'm very excited about. There are so many great speakers and panels. And when you get to join us, I'll be doing a nature walk and moderating a wonderful panel on activating community spaces with two incredible women, an architect and an urban planner.
So this summit is put on by the Biophilic Institute and Biophilic Cities Project. So you can also come meet all of the leading experts in biophilia. And in addition to all incredible multiple presentations, we're going to have all sorts of great farm-to-table meals, plus cocktails, some book signings, and lots of networking, which is always a favorite. And it's going to be at your and my favorite place, the Inn at Serenbe.
Yep, that's one of my favorite places, as you know. So join us in Serenbe for the 6th Annual Biophilic Leadership Summit from March 24th to March 26th, 2024.
And you can learn more about the summit and register today at biophilicsummit.com.
That's biophilicsummit.com. We hope to see you there.
We'll see you soon. Bye, Jen.
Bye.
I always start with focusing on the lawn. It's the low-hanging fruit. If you reduce the area you have on, and I don't say get rid of it, it's the perfect plant to walk on. It's a cue for care. You know, lawn is a status symbol. So just tossing that status, that really goes against the culture. But if you reduce the area of lawn, the lawn you keep should be mowed and manicured, and then people don't object. You're simply having more plants in your yard. Under those plants, around those plants, particularly if they're trees, you're going to have beds. It's a little mini ecosystem from the canopy right down to the ground. You want to keep the leaves that fall from your tree because they contain nutrients that that tree used that year, those nutrients have to get back into the soil. And the soil is loaded with tiny little creatures that break down the leaves. They're detritivores. They're returning the nutrients to the soil. Then you have the mycorrhizae that are transferring the nutrients to the roots of your plants. All of that soil ecosystem requires high humidity, and that's what leaves do. It not only brings the nutrients, it's a blanket that protects the soil moisture. So designing a landscape where you can retain all the leaves that fall and you have this closed nutrient cycle, you're not putting them out to the curb as if they were garbage. It's simply realizing that important ecological things are happening on your property. It's not just there as a decoration. We've got this idea that humans are here and nature someplace else. That worked in the old days when there weren't very many of us, but it doesn't work. There is no someplace else. There are humans everywhere, and we have to create ecosystem function where those humans are.
Oh my gosh. Everything you just said made me so happy, Doug, because I feel like those are the things that people are talking about, saying, oh, why does people have to feel like they have to put their leaves in plastic bags? And why were we taught that? But again, it's like, oh, because the lawn was a status symbol for so long. And now we, you know, we're finally starting. I mean, you've been doing this for so long, but people are starting to finally listen, I believe, to why it's important to bring this ecosystem for the human health and for neighborhood health, community health, and so on. I think it's fascinating. That's finally, your work is finally being heard by more.
Good news.
Yeah. But I think it's really an interesting thing. I mean, for me, it's all about knowledge, right? So it kind of seems like it's out in the ether about keep your leaves on the ground, or, you know, break them up and use them sort of as a compost on your bed. But I didn't realize, and it makes perfect sense, I had like a little bit of an epiphany where you're like, when the leaves drop, those are essential nutrients that are, it's not that they're dead. Like we think of them as dead leaves, right? Or to get rid of. But that's an essential part of the tree, and that the cycle, to your point, there's a reason why they dropped. And the world didn't, you know, there weren't like, I don't know, landscape guys who took away your leaves thousands of years ago. They stayed, and there's an actual reason for them. But it kind of struck me as somebody who's been told not to throw them away, or if I do, use them for compost. But that the high humidity, like the whole process is like, we have to understand that in order to appreciate it, execute it, and protect our soil, so I don't know. And that was like sort of a funny thing, but I really like that detail. So what other sort of little tidbits do you have? Because to me, that education, what other things can we do? We should reduce the lawn, remove those non-native plants, invasives. Like here, I'm in the South, kudzu is everywhere, you know, and is just a beast. What other things can we do? What are some keystone species that really contribute that we can put in?
Well, you've got kudzu, but you've also got privet, and you've got burning bush, and you've got bush honeysuckle, and they're covering millions of acres too. So it's not just kudzu. The most important scientific tidbit that we have discovered in my lab is this concept of keystone plants. It's not just native versus non-native. It's productive plant versus unproductive plant. It's the plants that are going to, I call them contributors. They're contributing the most energy to our local food webs. They're plants that don't contribute very much, and they're plants that actively remove it. And that's those invasive species that are pushing out the natives that contribute, and they're not contributing. So the keystone plant, you know, if you think of the Roman arch, the keystone is the stone in the middle of that arch. And if you take that stone out of the arch collapses. Well, if you take keystone plants out of your local food web collapses, because those are the plants making most of the food. If we just use caterpillars as an index, 14% of our native plants are making 90% of the caterpillars that drive those food webs. So that 14%, we say, okay, we're going to call those keystone plants. Now it's a continuum, you know, and the highly ranked ones are the ones you should go after. But if you don't have them, you could have a 100% native landscape that's very unproductive. It's not producing much because there are a lot. And that means 86% of our native plants aren't producing all that much. And I'll give you a good example. Oaks are by far the best keystone plant wherever they occur. So in the mid-Atlantic states where I am, they support 557 species of caterpillars, 950 species nationwide. Tulip trees, which are good native plants, they only support 21. So there's a huge difference among our native plants. And it's not that we don't want tulip trees. We just don't want only tulip trees. You want to have those powerhouses in there as well. And that's a brand new concept. Nobody was thinking about that. So getting that into the public consciousness is an important first step.
Can we dive into, because I'm really interested about how do you get these messages to the younger audience? So how do we get things like you talk about your nature's best hope? We'd love to learn more about that and how that really is adapted for those that are younger to really understand what's taking place around them. Do you have it behind you? We'd love to see
That's
it.
That's what happens.
That's it. There we go. That's perfect. Yes.
It's Nature's Best Hope, a young reader's edition. And the object was exactly that, to get this message to middle schoolers. I look at my own grandchildren. Any third grade up is fine. They could get the message. And, you know, we essentially rewrote Nature's Best Hope without leaving out anything in the language that middle schoolers use. So it wasn't watered down at all. It simply was translated into, you know, something that was probably a little bit more understandable. I've had adults say, oh, I like this version because I can understand it better.
I mean, that's true. Sometimes.
Meet people where they are. Meet people where they are.
But, you know, people say, well, we have to get this message to the kids, and they are right. But with this important caveat, we cannot wait another generations. We cannot say, kids are going to do it. We don't have to do anything. As we don't have that much time left. Plus, I look at, you know, particularly the audiences that come hear me, they're older folks. They're mostly baby boomers. But that's not a bad thing because baby boomers are tired. They've got the money, they've got the land, and they're looking for something to do. It makes them a very powerful workforce in terms. It doesn't mean they're out there pulling out the invasives, although some of them are. It's just in terms of being the activists that actually get this message out there. Our kids, they're in school, they're learning, they're interested, but they don't own the property. They don't have the money, you know, and as soon as they get a little older, they're going to be mate seeking, they're going to be career developing. It's not their top priority at this stage of their life. Yes, we want to get it to the kids, but that doesn't relieve us of the responsibility.
In your classes, are you still out there doing any teaching? Because I feel like the current landscape designers, future landscape designers should be thinking this way, right? To your point, the ornamentals are really pretty, and that's kind of what you see a lot going in. But the natives are important. But then, you know, we're drilling down further. A tulip tree is different than an oak. So what are you seeing? Are you seeing landscape designers take an interest and make changes?
Yeah, I would say landscape architects have shown a bigger interest because the nature of their training is more about the hardscape of the landscape and not the specific plants. Landscape designers have their favorite plants and they don't want to give them up.
Okay.
They're a harder sell. But, you know, I thought there'd be a lot more pushback. There's been some pushback from the horticulture trade, but we're not saying you can't sell plants anymore. You can't use plants anymore. We're just saying change your inventory. And it's exciting to a lot of people because it's new. This, which cultivar can we use this year? That gets old pretty fast, it seems to me. So you can design. So now we have, you know, in the past, we asked our landscapes to be pretty. Now we're asking them to be pretty and ecologically functional. And that's kind of a fun new challenge that designers and landscape architects, many of them are taking up. They are interested. And many of their clients are taking that up. There's this huge vacant niche out there in terms of landscape managers. Most people don't garden. Most people hire somebody. They hire the lawn care industry. I want to retrain the lawn care industry so that they can become the ecological landscapers. You just hire them. They'll put in the right plants. You know, native landscapes need to be managed just like non-native, maybe less management, but particularly when you're putting them in, they'll know what the plant choices are. So nobody's going to lose their job. We're not trying to kill an industry here. I'm just trying to change it its ecological functioning to their goals instead of just painting the landscape with pretty plants.
Do you think also because of climate change, like especially since 2020, I feel like there's been such a lot of things happening globally to the environment. Do you think this education that you're doing and this awareness helps people understand the magnitude of why we need to care and why we really need to put a focus back on the priority of biodiversity in our lawns?
Yeah, I think it's all tied together. They get a ton of bad news about climate change. It is a very serious issue, but it's not the only serious issue. If we had no climate change at all, we would still have a biodiversity crisis. And what's interesting to me is that you can address both of these crises with plants. And putting the plants back on the planet is not going to solve the climate issue, but it's going to help because a third carbon that's up there right now has come from us cutting down the forests and putting in millions of acres of lawn where there used to be well-vegetated ecosystems. So correcting that, that's what I mean by putting the plants back, is going to help climate change. It's going to sequester a lot of carbon, not just in the plants themselves, but all of those plants. And that includes the prairie forbs and the grasses with very deep root systems. They are pumping carbon into the soil every day. An acre of prairie sequesters almost as much carbon as an acre of forest, believe it or not, because there's they're pumping so much carbon into the soil. And once it's in the soil, unless it's turned over again by a plow or something, that's long-term storage, stays there for thousands of years. So again, it's not the only solution to climate change, but it's one that needs to be addressed a little bit more vigorously. And, you know, we've got the Trillion Tree campaign, and all those cities putting in millions of trees. That's great as long as they're the right species. It's a huge lost opportunity if the Trillion Trees is all eucalyptus. And around the world, it really is. I mean, they just say, well, all we need is a tree. Well, gee, you need a tree that's going to support the life around you too. And then you're helping climate change and the biodiversity crisis at the same time.
So one of the questions I want to dive back into the oaks, because that was your previous book, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Most Native Trees. Now, this came out after you did Nature's Best Hope. But what I thought was interesting is you kind of go month by month and the seasonal cycles of them. Are there oaks everywhere in the world? I mean, maybe not in a complete desert system, but are oaks native to most countries?
In the temperate zone, the northern temperate zone.
Okay.
There are 435 species of oaks. It's a big genus. We've got 91 species in the country. There are 200 species in Mexico. And they go all the way down into northern South America. But in the deep tropics, oaks drop out. It's more of a temperate species. So yeah, we can't talk about worldwide. In the U.S., oaks occur. There is at least one species of oak occurring everywhere except the northern Rocky Mountain ecoregions, like Idaho has no oaks. Montana has just the southeast corner has an oak. But I think California has, 31 species or something. The center of distribution is the southeast, where we got most of our species. So it's very widely distributed, but not absolutely everywhere, right? In the south, where you have very dry ecosystems, they're in the mountains. As soon as you get any elevation at all, there are a lot of oaks there.
They're such a cool tree because they're so different. I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles and we had an oak in our front yard, but the leaves were super tiny and prickly and they had acorns coming down from them. And then when I moved to Georgia, we had a post oak in our front yard, which was a big, I guess, maybe a more traditional oak tree leaf. I don't know much about them, but it's kind of been fun to try and learn a little bit more when you move about the country.
It's a more traditional leaf in the East, Now, most people who live in California came from the East. So they're looking, they think all oak leaves are lobed, but they're not. There are oak leaves with no lobes at all. As you said, the ones with the little spines, they look like holly leaves.
Yeah.
Those are adaptations for hot, dry climates. Oak leaves, there's something called the willow oak. You've got willow oaks in Georgia, and the leaf looks like a willow leaf. So there is a lot of variability in oak leaves.
We always celebrate our oaks. And I live right next to Central Park. So Central Park is full of the oaks, and everyone always talks about the gloriousness of how wonderful the oak trees are in Central Park. And it's just beautiful to see them throughout the seasons, even though it's dead of winter now. And it's just spectacular how glorious they are.
They are. They're my favorite.
Yeah, me too.
Do you have another book coming out with a different tree species, or is oaks your favorite and you're sticking with them? And have you grown any on your property?
Oh yeah. What do I have? Some of the 15 species we've put in. Now remember, our property was moved away, so we planted all of those. Well, me, the Blue Jays, me and the
I love it. That's great.
Because they carry in and plant them themselves. But I do have another book in the works. I could write a book about other trees the same way I wrote about oaks, because other trees are wonderful too. But the next book is really dealing with the questions that people have asked me over the last 5-10 years. These are good questions that after they've heard me talk and after they read the books, they still have good questions. So I said, I got to answer those too. So that's the next.
Yeah. Good. So when can we expect that one to come out? Is that coming or is it?
It takes forever. I mean, it's in editing right now. It won't be out until the spring of 2025.
Okay. Where are you these days? Like, where do you find yourself day to day out there speaking? Where have you felt like you've had the most impact? Is it the books? Is it one-on-one? Is it?
I think I have the most impact with the most naive audience, the audiences that have never heard this. I go give a talk and somebody come up to me and say, I've heard you 6 times. Well, they've got the message, you know, and I'm not going to have a bigger
right.
Answer, but
right.
I just got back from Utah. I'm going to Idaho next week. So it's really all over. The only place I haven't talked in person is North Dakota.
And that's still next. That's
there.
Next.
But, you know, the states that have made, it was interesting. One of my very first talks was in Michigan. And I got an email from somebody. And they signed it. It wasn't anonymous. And they said, you can come to Michigan, but nobody's going to listen to you. Okay, great.
Very nice.
Yeah. But whoever that was wrong, because Michigan has been a major supporter ever since.
Wow. I've gotten
all the talks. Indiana, big. New England, all over New England. Virginia, Georgia, a lot in Georgia. The California Native Plant Society, you know, it's a huge paid organization. So where have I had the biggest effect? I don't know. But whenever I tell people there's something you can do to turn around these terrible headlines, they get excited. So,
yeah. I think that's great too, Doug, is because we often talk or we often think we have to go speak to our constituents that are always listening to us. But when we go to these rooms that no one has ever heard or thought about what you're talking about, it really opens eyes. And then they say, oh my God, I had no idea. And that's exactly where those needles really get to be moved. And getting ourselves out of the silos where we usually speak is like the greatest opportunity to go and really spark excitement in people that are so used to the climate doomism. Where Monica and I always talk about, we are all about climate hope. And that's why we want to have these conversations with people like yourself who are really hopeful about what we can do to make a difference, not only today, but tomorrow and into the future too with the work. So, yeah, I think
well, this
you're
is
right
exactly
about
why we created the nonprofit Homegrown National Park, was to get this message to what we call the non-choir, the millions and millions
love
of people
that.
Who don't have a clue about this. And that involves social media, involves, you know, recording your property on the map and competition between states, trying to use every trick in the book to get it to go viral. And it's working. The nonprofit part of Homegrown National Park is that we really are good at the non part because we don't.
It's hard to be a nonprofit.
It takes money. It takes money. And when it's only on donation, it's really hard. So,
well, it's like the work of a caterpillar. I'm just saying, hold on, wait. I think it's like the work of a caterpillar. You're moving slowly, but it's profound and then it's beautiful and people are attracted to the message that the butterfly gives and the caterpillar. So I think you're doing the work of the caterpillar in a very profound way.
That's a good analogy, but there is urgency here. There is some urgency. So I did an interview this morning before I got on with you, and she asked if it's too late. And it's only too late when the species that are going to run our ecosystems are extinct. And if you're talking about insects, they're really resilient and reproduce quickly. They can come back if you give them what they need. If you give them the plants they need, if you change your outdoor lights at night from white lights to yellow lights, because that kills insects. If you fire your mosquito fogger, which kills the monarch and kills all the pollinators we're trying to support and doesn't control mosquitoes, these are things that we can do to stop the carnage that's out there. But if we wait till these species are extinct, then it doesn't come back. Then it is too late. But they're not extinct. And that's a good message from our property with all those moss species that have come in. They wouldn't have come in if they weren't here, but they are in little bits of habitat that is left. So insects are really resilient. And, you know, when I wrote Nature's Best Hope, you are nature's best hope. But that's because we need this army of private property owners everywhere to do their little bit. And that builds up the populations that can then colonize the next house that does it. Yeah, it's like good news.
No, it's hugely important. And I love what you're doing. And I'm honored to have you on and thrilled to share your message. So where can people find you? Is the best place to go to Homegrown National Park? Or do you have your own social media? Where would you like us to support?
It all happens through Homegrown National Park.
Okay.
I mean, that's the beauty of it. I don't do social media, you know.
Understood.
Yeah, totally get it.
I've never even gone there. I don't know my password. it's great. Like a hub. They call it Talamy's Hub. It's got, you know, publications there and the important websites and the messages and the map and the social media. We have a great guy, Grant Jensen, who does our TikTok and other things. And, you know, it's popular. He put something up there about container gardening and he got 8 million hits.
Wow.
That's good. I talk to people. I don't talk to 8 million people. I'd like to, but so.
Yeah, no.
The message is spreading.
Social media can be super powerful. Yeah, super powerful. Well, we are going to put all your books up on in our show notes. We're going to put Homegrown National Park and How to Connect and Give, as well as I really like that Smithsonian article, The 8 Steps to Rewilding. And I think you're right about, we didn't really touch on the lighting and the mosquitoes, but get a bat box, you know, find a different way, or birds eat mosquitoes, right? All of our little bunch of our birds eat mosquitoes. So
the Swifts, yeah.
The Swifts are fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much. I mean, you're doing great work.
Thank you, Doug. Yeah, thank you. This was a wonderful conversation. I've learned a lot. So I really appreciate your time today.
And new ways to communicate too. Yeah. Thanks so much, Doug.
Bye-bye.
So Monica, of all the ground we covered with Doug, I'm curious to know what your biggest takeaways were.
Well, it's a great question. I had so many, but I think I would start with this notion of keystone species. That was sort of a new term for me. And I think sometimes people hear these ideas like native plants and they don't really understand what that means. So I know that planting an oak tree in my yard is a really good first step. Then it feels like I have a strong baseline for building knowledge about those keystone species.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And on that note, I would quickly point out to the listeners that Homegrown National Park website and go there because there's an amazing tool where you can search for native plants based on your state and find resources for finding local plants in your area.
Yeah, that's such a cool resource. So, you know, I also loved that Doug acknowledged that, yes, lawns aren't really doing much for us in terms of biodiversity, but don't feel like you need to completely overhaul your yard. Like that can feel kind of overwhelming. Start with a small, manageable area, put in a native tree, a pollinator, and go from there. You know, we promise that just that step will make a difference.
Oh my gosh, yes. Again, it especially makes a difference if a lot of people commit to taking that small step. It's way more effective for a million people to convert a quarter of their yard to native plants than it is for one person to totally refit their yard. So start small and then tell your friends how easy that really was.
Yes. And, you know, they'll walk by and see how fabulous your yard looks.
Exactly.
And so the other thing was the leaves. I mean, gosh, I loved what you said during the interview about how insane it is that we literally collect these fallen leaves and throw them away in like plastic bags when they can be so beneficial for the soil and ecosystem. So we're used to seeing that, but it's a really backward activity.
Yeah, it really is so absolutely insane. But we'll start to see, I think, less of that kind of thing if people are generally aware of how bad it really is. It reminds me a bit of plastic straws. They become so associated with ocean pollution that it's bad to even be seen using one.
Absolutely. And you know, we have tons of resources in our show notes. And I guess I'll talk to you later, Jen.
Bye, Monica.
Thanks so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, we would love for you to follow us on our favorite listening app. Give us a 5-star rating and please leave us a review.
Listens, follows, and reviews really go such a long way and help us share these amazing interviews and solutions for wider network.
Absolutely. And we'll be back with another great guest in a few weeks.